Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Hey, warm welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here with you. It's so nice of you to be with me this afternoon. It's another spectacular day here, and it's beautiful in the Twin Cities. I hope it's nice where you are at today. And it's summertime. It's middle of the summer, and we're loving it. I don't know if you get out and go to the pool or get a chance to do some of that, those recreational activities. You know, I notice the only places I see the sign "no horseplay" is either in locker rooms or pool sides. Yet I've never seen a horse in either location. I don't get that. So I was getting my car filled up with gas today, and that little paper towel dispenser, have you ever been able to get a paper towel out of that dispenser without shredding the first three paper towels? Then you go, ah, the fourth one is finally like a whole one. I think that's part of the reason that we have so much waste, because the dispensers don't work good. All right, we have a great show today. We've got Jared Stepman from the Daily Signal. He's going to come on the program in just a minute or two, and we're going to talk to him about what went on last night at the White House with the Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. And then we're going to talk to Saul Selby. He's got a prison ministry he's had for quite a while. He's also a vice president of clinical services at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. But as you know on the show, we love scripture. So let's start with Shan quoting from Colossians.
Colossians 1:15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him.
Your prayers matter and are heard by God. When you pray, lives can be changed. Each week, the Faith Radio prayer team joins together to pray for relationships to be strengthened, finances to be increased for God's glory, for our leaders to follow God's will, and for so much more. Will you join us? The Faith Radio prayer team, made up of hundreds of listeners, receives an email with each week's prayer focus. You can be a part of the Faith Radio prayer team by signing up at myfaithradio.com.
You've likely noticed some recent programming changes here at Faith Radio. To help keep you informed about all of our programs, we encourage you to view our program guide at myfaithradio.com. The program guide lists every show, the time it airs, and information about the host. You can also listen to the podcast of any programs you missed. Stay up to date on your favorite shows. Just click on the Programs tab at myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back to the show. Awfully glad you're with me today. Bill Arnold here. You know, Jared Stepman is my guest. He's the editor and commentary writer for the Daily Signal, and he's also a co-host of the Right Side of History podcast. And I get the feeling he did not get much sleep last night after the Supreme Court nomination was announced, and he's here to talk about that despite his lack of sleep. Hello, Jared.
Hello, and thank you for having me back on the program.
As always, a pleasure. So did you, am I right in my prediction? Did you get much sleep last night? Or were you up looking over all
the... You are correct.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of sleep last night. It was obviously one of the bigger news days of the year. I think any time there's a Supreme Court nomination, I think it always makes waves. It's always a big deal. I think there's a lot of anticipation for this July 9th announcement. And of course, even up until the final moments before the name was finally released of Brett Kavanaugh, I think there was a lot of speculation. What way was President Trump going to go? I think there was a lot of speculation, even up to the last seconds. Who is this person going to be?
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think Brett Kavanaugh is an establishment pick or a real conservative?
You know, I think he is an establishment pick that I think should make most conservatives happy. I think mm-hmm. that, and certainly there has been criticism, I think, you know, very much fair criticism of some of his decisions in the past regarding religious liberty. But, of course, he was on a D.C. district court with mostly liberals. I think it's a very different situation with him now on the Supreme Court, which has a different composition. So, frankly, he has been what I would consider very strong. Textualist, originalist, member of the courts. I mean, he certainly has a very long record of decisions, and not every jurist has a perfect record, for sure. I mean, even some of the greats that many conservatives like Justice Antonin Scalia, had some things a lot of conservatives were not happy about. So the idea that there's something fundamentally flawed about Kavanaugh, I think, is not correct. I think there's a reason to be distrustful, because many conservatives believe that they've been burned in the past. There's certainly been nominations by Republican presidents. Of course, Souter very, very famously basically sided with the left after being appointed by President George H.W. Bush. So I think there's very much reason to always be concerned, but given his record, I think he is a strong choice. I think a lot of conservatives would have rather have had Amy Barrett there instead, but I think a lot of people are going to be happy with this pick, and I think it is ultimately a very solid choice that will make a lot of conservatives, very happy.
Jared, is it safe to say that Amy Coney Barrett might be a choice down the road?
Well, I think that's definitely a possibility. I think some of the speculation is that it's possible that if Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, she could be the next in line replacement. Of course, that is pure speculation. We don't know if Ginsburg will retire or leave the court or whether or not she will be considered. But I do think she was a strong candidate for this position. And I would have certainly enjoyed seeing the confirmation hearings for Barrett, because she got attacked, I think, very viciously by many for her religious beliefs, which I think in many regards became quite odious, attacking her beliefs in this kind of way. And I think it would be a welcome debate to see that essentially going up in the Senate and having this larger debate over where a person's religion is in public life. I think a lot of the attacks on her were incredibly unfair and quite vicious for somebody who is incredibly well qualified, who has such a good legal background and is such a strong jurist. I think it was very unfair. So for sure, I think she will be a top leading candidate if another vacancy does come to the court. And I think certainly a lot more people now will be paying attention to what she does. So I think she's definitely among that upper rung of candidates that conservatives will look to if this opportunity comes again during the Trump presidency.
Mm-hmm. Jared, I didn't have to go back too far to look at who voted what on the Neil Gorsuch confirmation, which was in April of 2017. And I'm looking at the Democrats that voted yes for Judge Gorsuch. It was Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin, and Joe Donnelly all voted yes. It was 54-45, and they needed 51 votes to ensure confirmation. What do you think is going to happen in this confirmation?
Well, I think this is going to be ultimately a tighter run thing than that one. I think there was it was very, very difficult for Democrats to oppose the Gorsuch confirmation, especially those who are in what you generally consider red states. And I think there will be this time a lot of pressure on them to flip. Unfortunately, the problem is the progressive base is very much worked up about this seat, is very aggressive and strident. And I think a lot of these senators that are Democrat senators and states that have a sizable conservative population are going to struggle to make votes. But, of course, I think a lot of them, unfortunately, are probably going to flip and vote against confirmation, which I think would be a problem. Of course, it makes it much tighter for Republicans, who I think there's still speculation about what Lisa Murkowski, Senator Murkowski of Alaska, and Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who tend to be much more moderate, what they're going to do when it comes to this vote. And I think that will be ultimately the deciding factor in whether or not Kavanaugh gets confirmed.
Mm-hmm. Jared, what would you consider to be some of the critical questions that Kavanaugh will get asked by the opposition?
Well, I mean, obviously what we're going to have, especially what the left really prioritizes right now, I think there's definitely going to be questions about the Roe v. Wade decision, which, of course, has very much animated the progressive base. I think there will be some more detailed questions about what essentially he thinks about administrative law. I think that's a big thing that I think a lot of conservatives have a reason to be very hopeful about, is that Kavanaugh tends to not basically like the Chevron decision, which gave deference to executive agencies to interpret statutes. And essentially that has empowered the bureaucracy over a generation. I think Kavanaugh very much is doubtful that jurisprudence, which was even given kind of the thumbs up by those like Scalia. So it puts him to the right, even of people like Antonin Scalia. So I think that's going to definitely come up in these hearings, some of his very strong views in some of these cases. And he has such a long record. He's decided over 300 cases in the last decade, and he definitely has a long record that's going to be scrutinized very heavily by both Republicans and Democrats. But frankly, I think his long record does kind of speak for itself. He's a very, very able jurist. He has some backing from some, I would say, liberal professors. There was a article in the New York Times today by Akhil Reed Amar, who is a liberal professor at Yale who taught him, who said he's very, very well qualified, that you really, President Trump couldn't have picked anybody who's more well qualified than Kavanaugh. So I think there's going to be some difficulty in making the argument this individual should not be sitting on the Supreme Court, other than the ideological pushback to his textualist originalist views.
All right. We are talking Supreme Court nomination Judge Brett Kavanaugh. We're doing that with Jarrett Stepman, editor and commentary writer for The Daily Signal, also co-host of The Right Side of History. We'll take a short break and be back with lots more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. We have Jarrett Stepman on our studio line. He is the editor and commentary writer for The Daily Signal and co-host of The Right Side of History. Awfully glad that he can join us today. He's been working hard. He's been our starting pitcher and throwing lots of fastballs, giving us lots of good information on what's going on in Washington, D.C., where he lives and works. Jarrett, let me ask you about a little bit more about Judge Kavanaugh. Who would you compare him most to on the court right now?
You know, I think a lot of people made the comparison to Justice Alito on the court. I think that's a pretty good comparison. Again, every jurist will be a little different. I mean, there were some significant differences between Scalia and Thomas, for instance, two considered very conservative on the court. But I do kind of push back on this idea that he should be more moderate or something like that. I mean, when you're interpreting the text of the Constitution, I think that moderation, bringing something closer to your views, is not the right way to go. It's in reading the text as it is and reading the law as it is. And I think that the Kavanaugh has said, and he has been at a lecture at the Heritage Foundation last year, the Joseph Story lecture, and he said that he will follow the law of the Constitution, that he looks to the original text and original meaning of essentially our Constitution in the United States. And I think he will be very much faithful to that. I think that's what he has built his entire career on. He certainly has enormous experience. He worked with Judge Anthony Kennedy before, and he has a huge array of students who have clerked on the Supreme Court. So he is very well respected as a strong legal mind, and I think that is where he's getting a lot of praise, that he is one of the more able lawyers in the country who has a firm understanding of the Constitution inside and out.
Well, that's super encouraging. I saw his speech last night from the White House, and I must say he was charming and warm, very appealing. I mean, he was I thought he did a great job. I assume you watched the speech.
I did, and I thought he was. And I think a lot of his background, of course, he's a coach of a girls' basketball team. She has two daughters who play basketball. And I think there's been some criticism that he's somehow anti-woman. I mean, I know the very left-wing Women's March attacked him after. But, you know, most of his clerks have actually been female. I mean, that's something that he says he's very proud of. And certainly I think the criticism that he is anti-woman, I think, is very unfair to him. And he seems to be a man who has his head set on straight on his shoulders. And I think certainly his personality is a positive on the court. I think he's going to work well with the other justices. He has a good relationship with Elena Kagan, who's on the Supreme Court, in many ways like how Scalia and Ginsburg have had a good relationship. So I think those are all positives that speak well of him on the Supreme Court. I think it's going to be very difficult to attack him, either for his obvious legal standing and his understanding of the Constitution, the text, and history, or his character and personality. I think it's going to be very hard to attack him on those things, other than the ideological argument, which is against his originalist views, which is, of course, many on the left are, I think, most worried about.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of amusing. A friend of mine called, and he gets the Democratic newsletters, emails. He says, I just like to, see what they're saying and what they're doing. And he said literally 5 minutes after it was announced, he got an email for a fundraising letter to try to stop all this. And he said it was very funny because it talked about Judge Brett Kavanaugh, but then it continued to use the pronoun she in the email as if they had written it about Amy Coney Barrett and just forgot to change the pronouns before they sent it out.
You know, this was a very common thing. I mentioned the Women's March also coming out. They forgot to even put a name on their denunciation of Kavanaugh. They put actually XX, thinking that they were going to put in a name later, saying that XX is going to lead to the death of millions of Americans. So obviously a pretty extreme statement from them. And it's clear that, especially if you've been listening to how the left has been reacting in the weeks before this nomination, they were going to oppose and denounce whoever the pick was going to be, whether it was going to be Barrett, whether it was going to be Kavanaugh, whether it was going to be Hardiman, whoever this pick was going to be, was going to be attacked and denounced. It's very clear. I mean, we even had op-eds from many left-wing publications even saying that they should start to think about court packing in the future, putting more justice on the Supreme Court when they get back power. These are very extreme statements in leading up to the nomination of somebody who they didn't even know who it was going to be yet. So I think you're getting a lot of that from the left, and I think there's going to be a lot of hysteria about this nomination because they see the change on the court. They see it moving in a more originalist, textualist direction, and a lot of them believe that their policies will essentially be struck down by the court as unconstitutional. And I think they're worried that the Supreme Court is not going to be an engine for progressive policy. And I think that is why they're reacting so strongly to the Supreme Court pick.
Yeah, you know, Jared, I think hysteria is really a good term. I saw there was a man on the street doing an interview with students saying, what did you think about President Trump's nomination pick? And they were all outraged. And he had not even made the pick yet.
Well, I think that's a very common thing. It was kind of funny seeing that the New York University students who already were criticizing the pick for being a racist and a terrible person. And a lot of this, I mean, again, I think a lot of this simply, I think the left sees this as many ways a game changer. In a way, they didn't quite see the Gorsuch nomination as that. I think that certainly many of them very much dislike Gorsuch. They would rather not see him on the court. But the fact that he's replacing Anthony Kennedy, who was kind of a wild card on the court. He sided with, I think you would say, the right on the court in many cases. And in many cases, he sided with the left, and they, of course, celebrated him on the left. I think many see this as a big game changer. And in many ways, it is also a part of President Donald Trump's legacy. This is now the second justice he's putting on the court. I mean, obviously now these two justices are going to have a lot of long-term impact. The odds are they're going to be in that court for a long time, for a generation. They're fairly young. Many people on the left are very much worried that the court will essentially be a bastion for the right in the near-term future. And so they are reacting to this in a much more, in some ways, hysterical way because they think that that is what's ultimately going to happen. And I think there's a little bit of a mistake in that because I think, as even Kavanaugh has said, you know, he believes in interpreting that the law as it is. That doesn't necessarily is going to fulfill a conservative policy or a liberal policy. It simply means that he's going to enforce the Constitution, a rule in favor of the Constitution as it's actually written, as it was actually intended. And for many on the left, that is a threat for what they see as their agenda.
Jared, I think the left is still kind of miffed about the Merrick Garland nomination and that fact that he never got a hearing. So they're going to try to get some revenge, aren't they?
I think that's true, although I must say, I mean, a lot of have said that, well, this was Merrick Garland's seat and things like this. I would remind them that originally the reason why Kennedy was even on the seat to begin with is because of what the left did to Judge Robert Bork years and years ago when Ronald Reagan nominated him for that seat, and he was essentially torpedoed by Democrats who controlled the Senate at the time, which led to Kennedy being on the court, which, of course, led to his vacancy now. So I think that there's a little bit of obviously, they see this as a huge problem for them. I think that the argument that Garland deserved to be on the court, I mean, we've seen vacancies come up in the past at the end of a president's term. The president does not, and his party does not control the Senate at that time. Almost never will he actually get another justice on the court. So the idea that this is somehow deeply unprecedented, that it was stopped, Merrick Garland was stopped, I think it's just not accurate. And I think many on the left, they expected Hillary Clinton to be president of the United States. And once Donald Trump became president, it's very clear that it became much of a problem for them. And now, of course, they're contending that this is a stolen seat in the court. But I think it's a rather flimsy argument. And I don't think it's ultimately going to fly overall with the American people.
True. Now, Jared, who won the bet at the Daily Signal?
Well, a few of my coworkers did certainly place, I would say, imaginary kind of wager.
Right.
I kind of suspected that it would be Kavanaugh, but I was wrong last time. I thought it was going to be Hardeman over Gorsuch, and it turned out to be Gorsuch. So I think there were a lot of people either way. I think most people were pretty happy. I think there were a lot who wanted to be Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't try to place any predictions. I intentionally tried not to because oftentimes I've been wrong on these, and ultimately, you know, it was the president who knew. But so I think the office was more or less correct. I think more people guessed this than not. But I think most of them are very happy with the eventual pick.
So one last thing, Jared. I know that Kavanaugh's got a lot of support from the Bush family. Did you think that was going to be a factor in the decision that President Trump was going to make?
I don't think it was going to be a deep factor in the decision.
Okay.
Of course, the Bush family, I think obviously there's been a lot of tension there with Trump and certainly all the Bushes. But I think that ultimately, you know, I think President Trump was going to pick somebody who he thought he had a good chance to be on the court, who was going to uphold a strong legacy, certainly somebody who was going to be on that list of 25 justices, potential justices that the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation gave to him. And he knew that it was very important for the conservative base and the Republican Party in particular to get somebody good on the Supreme Court. This is why many supported President Donald Trump ultimately. And he knew that he had to get a good pick. I don't think his loyalty or non-loyalty to any particular family, I think, ultimately made his decision. I think he did choose the person he thought would be best on the court that would have the likeliest to be confirmed. So I think those were the ultimate reasons. Of course, you know, one could always try to divine one way or another why somebody was chosen. But I think at the end of the day, this is such a momentous decision that those kind of personal debates and squabbles, I think it was more or less overcome by the fact that it's incredibly important for the future of the country.
And Brett is 53 years old, so that says there's still hope for me.
Well, that's right. He's a very young man.
Yeah.
Overall, he certainly the potential to be on the court for
a long time,
on whether or not he retires.
Yeah.
Certainly is, I'm sure, is a factor that gets involved in the stuff. And, you know, he's at the perfect age where he's had a lot of experience, and he's also still quite young and still very, obviously, very, very sharp. So I'm sure that was a factor in the decision. It certainly would be strange if it wasn't. So the potential that he could be on the court for a very long time into the future.
Jared, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on to the show and lending us your expertise, which is always spot on. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much for having me on. I much appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jared. Jared Stepan's been my guest from the Daily Signal. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. I like interrupting those horns. There we go. Welcome back to the show. It's 32 minutes after the hour. Saul Selby is the Vice President of Clinical Services at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge and has been involved in jail ministry for quite a while. As a matter of fact, the story of this ministry is quite impressive, and it has roots right here at Northwestern College. And I hope I tell this story right, but John Bartosik went into a jail, this is in the 70s, in Hawaii with his brother, Rick, who was a chaplain there. He realized that the incarcerated men who knew Christ had more freedom in their hearts than he did and committed his life to Christ. So he went to Northwestern College and began to volunteer in jails at Lionel Lakes. And then he transitioned from working in his carpet cleaning business to full-time ministry, which was his passion. He ended up developing leukemia and was hospitalized, but never complained. And as soon as he was out, he was back in the jails, sharing the gospel with youth and adults. And then in the late 70s, he formed a trust and a board to oversee the ministry. He continued directing it until the Lord took him home. And now Saul Selby is the one who's been in charge of that ministry. And it's a powerful ministry. And Saul's a committed guy, or should be committed, one of the two. Hi, Saul.
Hi. That's a lot of detail. Are you reading that off a web page, or is that something you set to memory? Where did you get all that information?
You know me. You know me, Saul. I memorized it months ago in preparation for this interview.
Yeah, well, you got everything right, with the exception of the pronunciation of John's last name, which he pronounced Bartosik.
Bartosik, okay.
So you were very close, but he was quite a guy. He was a very impressive individual, particularly, you know, I mean, the last two or three years he lived, he had leukemia. He would routinely have organs removed from his body.
Oof.
And I never heard him complain. I mean, he just was so grateful for his relationship with Christ and the opportunity he had to minister to people in jail. He was really an inspirational man, and he died in his 30s. I don't think he hit 40.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a guy.
So how long have you been active in MEC, Missionary Evangelism to Corrections?
Yes, I began to volunteer with John probably around 1983-ish, 82 maybe, something.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around there, a number of years ago, decades ago, a long time ago. I had quite a bit more hair at
uh-huh.
the time, and I had less weight. So I've grown since I've been involved with MEC. So that's what jail ministry will do. It'll help you grow.
Yeah, and you're Karen is involved in it as well, your wife. Do I have that right?
Right. She actually manages the ministry on a day-by-day basis. So she is the associate director, and she's the one that coordinates the activities of volunteers, orients volunteers, gets
mm-hmm.
them into the jail, provides training for them, works with the jails themselves, which is kind of a significant piece. So she's the one that really spends a lot of time with the ministry. I've got another job as well, so fortunately Karen is able to woman the helm,
yeah.
So to speak.
So, Saul, do your best to sell all of our listeners on maybe becoming a volunteer to a jail ministry, and how powerful it is and how wonderful it is, because I know there's a lot of people listening going, that sounds kind of scary to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can understand why it sounds scary on a couple of levels. I mean, one level of fear people have is just walking into a correctional facility where the door locks behind you. It has an eerie feel perhaps the first time you do it. And the second level of anxiety that people have is, you know, who am I dealing with? Am I dealing with, you know, Genghis Khan or Adolf Hitler? I mean, you know, how scary and dangerous are, what's that?
I think they're dead, those two.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, so what's a more current example? Let's just stick with dead people for
okay,
now.
Let's.
I mean, it's an illustration.
It could
it's
be Manson. Okay, all right.
It's a metaphor. Nancy. Okay, there you go. I don't want to offend somebody that's living and done bad stuff. So
No, of course not.
But the point is, I mean, there was a point to this, okay? The point was that, you know, certain people, particularly church people that don't necessarily have a correctional background themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, may have some intimidation about dealing with people that have broken the law, which is understandable. And so that anxiety is real. We recognize that. So, but the reality of the experience is quite a bit different. I mean, basically, you're going into a room with a bunch of people that are desperate to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. They probably, I mean, for anybody that likes evangelism, that for anybody that likes telling other people that Jesus is real, he wants a relationship with you, he's willing to forgive you of your sins, he's willing to give you a new life, he's willing to instill the Holy Spirit in you, he's willing to give you the discipline and the strength you need to be productive. If anybody likes telling other people that kind of stuff, there's no better place than jail ministry. No better place than jail ministry, because that's exactly what the people in these jails want to know. They want to know that they're forgivable, despite the fact that they've done, you know, things that are, you know, not necessarily good or illegal. And they want to know that, you know, Christ is willing to have a relationship with them and that they can actually change, you know. And about 80% of the people in jail have substance abuse problems, so they're addicts, you know, looking for the power in many cases to stay off drugs and alcohol. So if you're somebody that gets turned on by evangelism, and you're somebody that gets excited about seeing other people grow in a relationship with Jesus Christ, this is the ministry to get involved with. And as an expert on addiction, I can say unequivocally that it's addictive.
Yeah, I would agree.
So it's for the people that like this kind of stuff that are actually engaged in trying to help other people find a relationship with Christ. Once you do it, you don't want to stop. There was a guy named Clark Goss who was one of the original board members. He's deceased now, but Clark was in his 50s back in probably 1980 or something like that when he got started with the jail ministry. And he didn't, you know, his background was he was a farmer, you know, kind of a plain-spoken guy that loved Jesus Christ. He started going to the jails, and he couldn't get enough of it. He started going 2-3 times a week, and what he would say well into his 80s is that there's no place I'd rather be than jail, and he meant it. And so we've got people that, you know, some people drop out because they decide it's not for them, and that's fine. And some people start with us, and they do it for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Mm. Yeah, there's a level of brokenness in jail that you see practically nowhere else. And there's such a level of appreciation for the people who are there when they're being visited by somebody. You're not going to believe how loved you're going to feel by these men and women that have that are receiving you into the jail. They're so delighted you're there. They want to know everything
right.
You know.
Right, you know, and I mean, you touched on a word that I think is really important, brokenness. You know, I don't know about you, but I mean, I was fairly resistant to a relationship with Christ until my life was in shambles. And, you know, the last vestiges of pride was decimated by my addiction. And it was at that point that I, you know, was humble enough to really reach out to God and begin that experience. And that's the way it is for a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, struggle with that level of humility until the circumstances of life cave in around them. And that's the experience of most people in jails, where it's clear to them by virtue of where they are that things are not working very well. And that brokenness really fosters a level of opportunity with the Lord Jesus Christ and those that represent him as they walk in those doors.
Mm-hmm. Now, Saul, because I host a radio show and I want to let our listeners, I want to give them as much information as I can. Let me ask you some simple questions. Like, what is the difference between jail and a prison?
Yeah, it's a good question. So every county has a jail. So jails are basically county-based facilities. And prisons are typically are state-run and federal facilities. And when a person gets arrested, they never go directly into prison. And maybe if they're violating parole or something, they might. But for the most part, when anybody gets arrested for either spitting on the sidewalk or committing multiple homicides, they start off in jail. So that's the starting point in the correctional system. Now people stay in jail for a day or a year, or up to a year. So basically, when they're in jail, if they're tried and they are sentenced and they're given less than a year, they typically will stay in a jail, in a county jail. But if they are tried and they have a sentence for over a year, they will typically then transition to prison. So, you know, there are many people that get involved in the correctional system but never step into prison because they just do their time in jails.
Mm-hmm.
So it is it's got the broadest opportunity to minister to people because more people come into the jails. Now, prisons, people stay longer, so there's really more opportunity for discipleship in prisons. But for evangelism, jails are the place to be.
Mm-hmm. So do jails offer lots of different kinds of religious programming? Do you ever leave the jail, Saul, on any given night, only to have the Muslims coming in leading a prayer service right after you?
You know, we're in 18 different jails, and you know, depending on the jail, you know, some jails have a broad variety of you know, chaplaincy opportunities. So for jails in, you know, Hennepin County, where you have a lot of Muslims, you know, they have the right to request services that, you know, would suit their religious interests. But it's not likely that a person that's interested in going to a Christian Bible study is going to necessarily want to go, you know, to see a Muslim religious person, you know, teach out of the Quran. But, you know, we compete more with sporting events on TV or, you know, recreational activities than we do with other religious services. So some people, if they're watching the Super Bowl, I mean, that may not be a great example. But, I mean, if there's a sporting event on TV that interests some people, that would be more competition than a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some jails that do, you know, accommodate people of different faiths. But needless to say, the vast majority of programming in these jails are going to be Christian because that's where the majority of the demand is.
Okay, so Saul, let's say I wanted to sign up and I wanted to come in and do some jail ministry, what would my time look like? I wouldn't be just sent to a corner with some inmate, would I? Tell me what it would be like.
Well, there's a process. So, you know, you could call Karen up and just inquire about the opportunities. But we have an online application on our website. So I know Karen likes it when people fill that out. And we screen people. I mean, we're very picky, but we don't let just anybody go into a jail and represent us. You know, as an organization, we are, a conservative evangelical organization. So we want the people that represent us to understand what the born-again experience is, they're biblically literate, they can communicate effectively, what the Bible says about, being born again, evangelism and discipleship, that we want people who are stable. We don't want people who have, you know, severe mental health issues themselves that make them unstable, or people who are very impulsive that might not represent the ministry extremely well. If we're willing to work with people who are new Christians, if they seem to be stable people who are willing to work under somebody else for a while, to make sure that they're effective at what they're doing and not ineffective. So, okay, the first thing is a screening. We're going to, you know, Karen is going to interview people, get an idea of, you know, really, are they a good fit for this ministry? We often ask for references. So, well, hopefully you're going to a church and there's a pastor that can support the fact that you're a stable person, then you'd be a good candidate to be involved in jail ministry. And then we assess, really, are you strong enough to do this on your own, or are you do you need to be mentored for a while and work under somebody who has an existing ministry? And then once you it appears that you're able to be independent, we kind of move you into a more independent opportunity. And then we also, you know, determine, you know, what kind of clients do you want to work with? You want to work with youth? Do you want to work with adults? Are you more comfortable with women? Are you more comfortable with men? Where are you in proximity to the jails we work with? Are you close to certain jails?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be better if a person doesn't have to travel for 45 minutes to do ministry. And then the next question is, how often do you want to minister? We have some people that are on rotations that minister once a month. We have some people that go in once a week. There are some people that go in once every 2 weeks. And then there are some people who, you know, go in more often than once a week because they have the time to do it and they have a strong interest in doing that.
Yeah.
So there's a process. There's an orientation. And the jail has a process as well. The jails won't say, oh, come on in, whoever you are. they're gonna require a background check, and they probably often, you know, each jail is a little different, but the jails often require an orientation to their system as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it might take 3 months to get people actually placed.
Interesting.
And it's so people have to be pretty willing to move through the process. Years ago, it was a little bit easier. We could just pretty much plop people into a jail service. But, you know, the jails have had enough problems with security and maybe volunteers being hurt, and they have liability concerns that they take more precautions.
Yeah, well, years ago you could volunteer to help drive some students to a pizza restaurant on a Friday night. Now you can't do that unless you've gone through a criminal back check.
Yeah, you got to have your fingerprints taken and all that. Yeah, you have your genes tested.
So let me take a little break. Stay with me. We'll take a short break and come back and have more with Saul Selby. It's 13 minutes till the top of the hour. I'll be right back. were not gone very long. It's 11 minutes till the top of the hour. Saul Selby's my guest. He's the Vice President of Clinical Services at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and he's been actively involved in jail ministry for a long, long time, and we've been friends for quite a while, and I've done a lot of prison ministry in my life. I've been in about 80 prisons across the country, oftentimes as a volunteer. So there you go. Saul, I'm fascinated to let our listeners hear of your story, because you grew up in a Jewish family.
Yes, this is true. I grew up in a Jewish family in New York. We weren't very religious, but I did go to Sunday school, I guess, for years, and or Hebrew school, I suppose, is a better way of saying it. And I got bar mitzvahed.
You're using a lot of evangelical language.
Yeah, no. It's confusing. I'm old, you know.
I see what's taken over.
Where it's kind of, yeah. So New York City was, when I was in New York at the time, about one third of the people that lived there were Jewish. A good percentage of the, you know, obviously my family was Jewish. A lot of my friends were Jewish. It was a culture I was familiar with. It was a religion that I was I participated in. At some point in my early teens, I became an atheist, but you know, still maintained my Jewish culture identity. And that changed to a large degree, you know, when I went into treatment. I was became a drug addict, probably at the age of 15, and entered treatment at the age of 27. Do you want me to go on with the story?
Yeah, please. It's very interesting.
Okay,
No, it's all good.
All right. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, basically I came from a broken family. My father was an alcoholic. My parents got divorced. I became very unhappy in the middle of all that, and I found drugs and alcohol gave me tremendous relief. I liked them for a while, and then I became addicted to them, and I couldn't really stop using them, and they began to destroy all the key areas of my life. I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't hold on to relationships. I began damaging my body. I became, you know, distant from my family. And finally, at the age of 27, I just said, enough is enough. And I checked myself into a treatment center in New York City with the idea of getting off drugs and alcohol. I had no interest in religion or God. I just knew that I had to stop using drugs and alcohol. And while I was there, I began to go through a very significant withdrawal. I was an opiate addict, amongst other things. And at the same time as I'm going through that withdrawal, the program there wasn't a Christian program, but they leaned heavily on the 12 steps. I sat in on lectures where they talked about higher power, God. I became offended and indignant, thinking, what kind of program is this? They seem to be suggesting that I need a relationship with a God that I know doesn't exist to be sober, and I began to contemplate leaving the treatment program. I thought, well, why stay? I mean, they're advocating a philosophy that really can't work for anyone, let alone for me, an atheist. But I got so desperate, I knew if I left, my life would only get worse. And I, because of the withdrawal, I felt like I couldn't stay. And I got so desperate, I did something. I went into a room, I closed the door, and I prayed a prayer to a God I didn't believe in. I said, you know, I don't know if you're there, but if you are there, I, you know, reveal yourself to me in a way that I can understand. And it was a prayer I prayed with great desperation and emotion at that time, despite the fact that I didn't believe in God. And I had an experience. Moments later, I sensed the presence of God in that room with me in a very profound and a very dramatic way. It transformed the way I felt. You know, all the withdrawal, discomfort I was experiencing dissipated. I began to feel peace. I began to feel hope. And I realized that this experience happened literally seconds after I prayed this prayer. In my mind, there was no question that it was God responding to that prayer, intervening in my life, making clear to me he did exist, making clear to me that he wanted a relationship with me, despite the very imperfect human being I had been. And as I'm having this experience, and what I'm describing, you know, this sensation of God's presence lasted for hours into the evening, and I was looking at the wall in my room, which had the 12 steps. I saw the third step, and I began to meditate on it, which said we made a decision to turn our will and life over to the care of God as we understood him. And I just began to ask myself, what does this mean, to turn my will and life over to the care of God? What does this mean? And the more I thought about it, it meant simply this, that God has a plan for your life, and you can choose whether or not to submit yourself to that plan or resist that plan. And since now I was convinced that God existed, I made the assumption, the correct assumption at the time, that his plan for my life had to be better than my plan for my life. And I simply said to him, look, I don't know what your plan for my life is, but if you show me what your plan is, I will do my best to do it. And I meant it, and I stayed in that treatment center. And then toward the end of my stay, my counselor had trained at Hazelden. I mean, this was all taking place in Manhattan, a treatment program in Manhattan. And my counselor trained at Hazelden, and she knew that the circumstances of my life in New York were less than ideal. And she suggested that when I get out of Smithers, that I go to Hazelden for another month of treatment. And I really thought this was a stupid suggestion. I thought, this woman, you know, isn't competent. You know, I'm perfectly fine the way I am. I can go back to my home and continue with my life. I don't know why I have to listen to her. And then after I left her office, I thought about it, and I realized that I told God that I would do what he wanted, that I would submit to his plan. And then it occurred to me, is it possible that his plan is being revealed to me by this woman's recommendation? And I decided to go to Hazelden. That was in January of 1980. And while I was at Hazelden, as I continued to pray for knowledge of God's will for me, I was witnessed to by a Christian. I began to read the Bible. And by the time I left that program, I had given my life to Christ. And I ended up staying in Minnesota. So I've been in Minnesota since 1980, concurrently involved with addiction treatment and jail ministry.
So that's just a great story. I mean, it's interesting that you...
I'm not making it up. It's true. It's
no,
not a
story. That's
really,
what's so impressive.
It really happened.
Yeah, no, I figured there were some embellishments in there somewhere, but for the most part, it was it was a real story. But it's so strong that you finally just say to God, if I don't know who you are, but I want to give my life to you. Isn't that more or less what you said that night?
Yeah, well, I mean, when he the first prayer was, you know, if you're there, show me,
mm-hmm.
and he showed me, and then the second prayer was, if you've got a plan for my life, I'm willing to do it, and that set the whole thing in motion, you know, and I mean, and I was quite serious. I mean, you know, the emptiness of an addict's life is significant, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Addiction, you know, it leads to death, and it leads to misery, and it leads to hopelessness, and it leads to despair. I hadn't experienced death, but I experienced the hopelessness and the despair and the discouragement, and this opened up a whole new way of life, a whole new opportunity for me, and it was extremely exciting.
Yeah.
You know,
any pushback from the family when Saul shows up and says, I love Jesus?
Well, pushback from the standpoint, I mean, you know, they were happy that I was, like, alive. They were happy, you know, I'm sure that they framed it in the way, well, you know, it's better to have a sober Christian Saul than a dead, addicted Saul.
Right.
You know, so I think that was the way they framed it. And, of course, I was doing what I could to witness to them. And tell them about the impact Christ can have on their lives as well as mine. But I wasn't ostracized. You know, it was just kind of weird to them what had happened.
Yeah.
And I think at some level they were hoping it would just it would wear out over time.
Yeah.
And it hasn't so far.
Fantastic. Saul, thank you so much for doing the show, and thank you for the work that you do and what God's laid on your heart to do, and you're just going and doing it. And I just I applaud you.
Yeah, well, thank you for the opportunity to be on air.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you keep up the good work, too. I like the work you're doing.
Well, thank you so
keep
much.
It up.
Yeah, all right, Saul. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yep. Saul Selby's been my guest. We'll take a short break. And coming up in hour two, we've got Todd Mullican going to be on the air. We're going to open up the phone lines. You're going to enjoy that hour. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.